primarily to weaken Iran, ready for changing the government of Iran. Well, it's all come to nothing. It's now crumbling in a really embarrassing way. And this is why the United States is so angry tonight.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from Manchester, and Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight, and I'm very grateful that you shared your thoughts and views with us in this edition.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ribbiyyun kathir. فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is
the headlines. Israel launches new airstrikes in central and southern parts of the Gaza Strip, killing a dozen Palestinians and injuring many others. Iran strongly criticizes European countries' interventionist positions, saying such positions only help foster terrorism. Plus, tens of thousands of Serbian protesters call for the resignation of top officials after two back-to-back shootings killed 17 people. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Miz. Thanks for joining us. Israel has carried out fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting several residential homes in central and southern parts of the territory. According to Palestinian media, Gaza City, Rafah, and Khan Yunis were major targets of Israel's early Tuesday airstrikes. The Israeli strikes have totally razed the number of Palestinian homes, leaving a dozen Palestinians, including women and children, dead and many others wounded. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, says three of its commanders, along with their wives, have been killed in the strikes. Following the strikes, Israel has imposed a total lockdown on Gaza. The regime has also warned settlers in nearby settlements to go to shelters, fearing possible rocket attacks from the coastal strip. To get the latest on that, our correspondent Mona Kandil joins us from occupied Ramallah, and we also have Khalid Barkat, journalist and activist from Vancouver, to give us an analysis. First, over to you, Mona. What is the latest that we have on what has occurred in the Gaza Strip?
Well, the Israeli military, following the airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, said clearly that they had assassinated three of senior leaders and officials of the jihad movement and the armed resistance group in the Gaza Strip, and that they were responsible for the recent, or they had gave orders for Palestinian fighters from the jihad movement for firing rockets on the lands occupied by Israel in 1948 on Israel and the Israeli settlements in the recent days, and that they were responsible for maybe issuing orders and the planning to carry out anti-Israeli operations in the occupied West Bank. One of those senior jihad movement leaders is Tariq Azzedine. We have to mention that Tariq Azzedine is originally from Jenin, from Arabi town in Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank, and he was a former Palestinian prisoner, and that he was expelled to Gaza Strip in when he was released in the exchange of prisoners deal with the Israeli with the Israeli soldier who was abducted by the Gaza Strip resistance groups Shalit. He was expelled to Gaza Strip, and today, unfortunately, he was assassinated with the Khalil al-Bahtini and Jihad Ghannam, two senior leaders of the jihad movement, and with their wives and a number of their children. We have to mention that the Israeli military said the this operation would continue, and they ordered Israeli residents of areas within 40 kilometers, that's 25 miles of Gaza, were instructed to enter or stay near bomb shelters amid fears of, let's say, reprisal attacks while the bombardment had continued. School in Israel had been canceled and shelters opened in southern Israel, according to directives issued by the Israeli military command this morning. We have to say that in the recent days, there was a kind of anger from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu within the Israeli regime itself. They were demanding for reaction when there had been anti-Israel operations and the assassinations in northern the occupied West Bank, and when it was clear that those Palestinian fighters from the jihad movement, and there was the firing from the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime and Israeli ministers were demanding Netanyahu to respond, to carry out an operation or airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, but nothing happened on that day, a few days ago, of course. Maybe it's the time today to respond. However, experts, whether Israeli experts or Palestinian experts, military analysts, are saying that the response now from the resistance groups in Gaza Strip and even in the occupied West Bank will be very serious, and that Netanyahu's regime will be paying high price and will be responsible for the consequences, of course.
Khaled Barakat, when you take a look at this military operation that's taking place that has concluded so far with the assassination of three of the resistance leaders from the Islamic Jihad, it was quite extensive based on the reports that we see here. 40 military aircraft and drones from Israel were involved in this. I'm curious as to find out from you why it is that Israel has planned this execution at this point, because 5 days ago, roughly, when you had Khadr Anan that was killed inside the Israeli jail, there were some skirmishes of which it was concluded with some interference, I believe, and mediation, which involved Egypt. But then you have about 5 days to pass, and then now you have this incident. What is your reading into this?
Well, I mean, this heinous Israeli crime is, it comes in a time where the Israeli government is in crisis. They're trying to solve their crisis at the expense of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance. And for the past 3 weeks, at least, we have been the warning that Israel is going to carry assassination against Palestinian leaders, especially in Gaza. The Palestinian resistance have said repeatedly that this is what Israel is planning to do. And in fact, we have even spoken about this in the show, and that is, you know, the Palestinian resistance are aware that Israel was plotting to assassinate Palestinian resistance. And this crime comes in a time where the Palestinian people are just about a week from commemorating 75 years of the continuing Nakba, the catastrophe of 75 years of exile and expulsion and dispossession. And so Israel wants to also, say that no one is going to be immune if you, resist occupation. We are going to punish you. But the real question is, did this ever deter Palestinian resistance or weaken the Palestinian resistance? The last time Israel carried an assassination against Palestinian leaders from Islamic Jihad, particularly when they killed the leader of their military wing, Khaled Mansour, and his comrades, a week later, 1,000 Palestinian youth joined Islamic Jihad, and the Islamic Jihad did not deter or change its policies or its positions. In fact, Islamic Jihad had become more stronger after the waves of assassination that it was subjected to by Israel. So this is a failing policies by the Israeli government. It will only they only commit crimes in order to fulfill some of their obligations to their public that is going totally Israeli fascism in the Israeli society. They want to say that look, we are delivering what we promise you. We are assassinating these Palestinian leaders. But this is a failing policy, and I think that the Israeli government is counting weeks, maybe weeks, and it's in its way to total failure.
Okay, it needs to be mentioned as I'm reading through and sifting through the reports that are coming that the three Islamic Jihad leaders were killed along with their wives and children, even though the statement that was released did not give details on that and in terms of how many children were killed or their ages. Khaled Barakat, when you take a look at the fact that this operation was carried out by Israel, Israel's, and I think you mentioned this, is at a weak point here. We've seen them not reacting based on what happened a few weeks back when there was rocket fire that came through from southern Lebanon. So militarily, they are, afraid to get engaged when it comes to any other groups except for the fact that they can target the Gaza Strip, as we have seen they did. Do you see them being at a weak point, and how do you assess the fact that Israel is dealing with the multiple challenges, both from within and with the fact that you have now all the resistance groups united on one page, therefore Israel feels threatened?
Israel feels threatened, and Israel wants to divide the Palestinian resistance, and they are failing in doing so. The Palestinian resistance, they're united. Their steps are going to be calculated very carefully. And at the same time, we cannot rule out the responsibility of the United States. They are responsible. I mean, these Palestinian children, their blood is on the hands of Biden. This administration have been covering the Israeli regime in all fronts. And also, the lesson to learn is not to trust the Egyptian regime, because the Egyptian regime was supposed to be brokering mediation between the Palestinian resistance and Israel, and the Palestinian resistance got assurances that there will be no assassination policies. They are dropping these bombs at children and families at night while they're sleeping. There's nothing heroic about what Israel did. What Israel committed is a crime. They are going to pay a price for this crime, but it might not be a price paid by the Palestinian resistance from Gaza. It might be a price that the Israelis will pay by Palestinians in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and inside 1948 occupied land. Because let's remember, the Palestinian resistance today in the West Bank are on the rise, and Israel have been carrying assassination policy in the West Bank for the past 3 weeks at least. They just committed a massacre in the West Bank, killing five Palestinian youth, and they are continuing their mass arrest. Just today, Israel have isolated the leaders of the Palestinian prisoner movement, Ahmed Saadat, Aed Abu Ghulma, Walid Hanacha. They're all in isolation, and they did this today, right before they carried their crimes. In my view, I think that the Palestinian resistance is very aware, and the Palestinian resistance camp in the region are very aware of what Israel is trying to do. They are now ready for a Palestinian response, but I think that the Palestinian resistance is going to be responding, but on its own terms and on its own time.
Thank you very much for that. Khaled Barakat, journalist and activist from Vancouver. And Mona Kandil, thank you so much, correspondent from Occupied Ramallah. The UN has called on Israel to respect Palestinian children's right to education and to stop demolition of their schools. The UN special coordinator made the comments in response to Israel's demolition of a Palestinian school in a small village east of Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. Tor Wennesland said demolishing schools and the eviction of Palestinian students are illegal under international law. He also expressed deep concern over the demolition of an EU-funded Palestinian primary school that directly affected the education of at least 40 children. UN officials said 58 schools serving 6,500 children currently face the threat of demolition due to a lack of building permits that are almost impossible for Palestinians to obtain. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister has strongly criticized the stance of European officials on the country's fight against terrorism. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Europe's interventionist positions only help foster this ominous phenomenon. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell. Amir Abdullahian was reacting to condemnations over the execution of Habib Farajullah Chab from the European Union and some of its members. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman had already slammed European countries for their criticism of the execution of the ringleader of a terrorist group. Nasser Kanani said some European governments support terrorists instead of fighting against those who put the lives of innocent civilians in danger. Chab masterminded several terrorist attacks in Iran, including the one on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz back in the year 2018. That incident left dozens of people killed or wounded. Iran's top general says the country is ready to share its defense capabilities with Oman, including in the fields of fighting terrorism and modern warfare. Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, made the remarks in a meeting with the Omani Deputy Prime Minister for Defense Affairs, Shihab bin Tariq al-Said. He said that Iran is also ready for intelligence and operational cooperation with Oman in fighting marine drug trafficking. Bagheri said foreigners are trying to take advantage of differences among regional countries, mentioning negotiations as the best way to overcome such differences. The Omani official, for his part, said Iran and Oman are responsible for ensuring security of the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. He added that the two countries should not allow enemies to use minor issues as a pretext to undermine security in the region. Iran has condemned the West's double standards on the use of chemical weapons, saying that they have made the U.S. Security Council unable to carry out its duties. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, Amir Said Iravani, was addressing a Security Council session on the situation in Syria. He said it is disturbing that Western states continue to use such double standards, including in the case of the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Iravani noted that the West is politicizing the Chemical Weapons Convention and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in favor of its own short-sighted political gains. He said the use of chemical weapons by terrorist organizations poses a grave threat and that Syria has repeatedly expressed its concern about this issue. Iravani emphasized that Syria remains committed to its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention and has continued its constructive cooperation with the OPCW. Tens of thousands of Serbians have rallied in the capital, Belgrade, calling for the resignation of top officials following two back-to-back shootings. The demonstrators first gathered in front of parliament before holding a rally near Serbia's government offices. Protesters called for the resignation of the interior minister and head of Serbia's intelligence agency. The education minister stepped down on Sunday, citing last week's school shooting. Similar protests were held in several other Serbian cities. The two shootings killed 17 in less than 48 hours, including 9 at an elementary school in Belgrade. Serbia is awash with military-grade weapons in private hands after the wars of the 1990s that tore apart the former Yugoslavia. And with that, we'll come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
World is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we said that the Islamic Revolution and its unmatched leader, Imam Khomeini, drew the attention of the world thinkers from the very beginning. In the previous episode, you heard some of the views of French thinker Michel Foucault on Imam Khomeini. Today, we will continue the discussion. Stay tuned, please. Michel Foucault was somehow linked with Iran's Islamic Revolution even before the victory of the revolution. He had signed some satiric statements alongside his compatriot Jean-Paul Sartre against the tyranny of the Pahlavi regime. The Italian daily Corriere della Sera asked him to write on Iran's developments. Thus, in order to get a better picture of Iran's revolution, he read many texts and reports on the country and the people of Iran. He met with some of the revolutionary figures and twice traveled to Iran in 1979. The sad tragedy of Cinema Rex in Abadan in 1978 had urged him to write his first set of reports on Iran. The arson in the cinema had been highly reflected inside the country and abroad. Michel Foucault sent 9 articles to the Italian newspaper during his 9-month stay in Iran. He visited different cities of Iran, especially Tehran, Qom, and Abadan. The French thinker had done interviews with some of the valid magazines and dailies, only to say that the Islamic Revolution was quite different from other movements of century in other parts of the world. Foucault's stances and notes about the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini can be analyzed in a few axes. One axis is his take on the status of religion in Iran's developments. The Islamic Revolution took place in a juncture when the dominant discourse in politics and thought indicated the isolation of religion in all social aspects of human life. During the bipolar era of the last decades of the 20th century, the liberalist ideology was dominant in many parts of the world and religion had been thoroughly marginalized as secularism was completely recognized and laicism was the ruling discourse, even in the most personal and individual matters. This was the condition of the Western capitalist bloc, while the Eastern Socialist bloc had not only isolated religion from every social and individual aspect of life, but also called it the opium of masses and a cause of exploitation of low-class and middle-class masses by the ruling class. In other words, Marxist school believed that religion not only does not liberate mankind from the yokes of the oppressors, but it justified oppression and injustice and was opposed to any movement against oppression. In such an age, the Iranian people staged the revolution with a religious structure and identity. They started their movement against the domestic tyranny and the foreign colonialism with the leadership of ulema, particularly the bravest of them, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Imam Khomeini proved that religion not only is not the opium of masses, but it is the liberator of the individual and society from the shackles of oppressors and tyrants. Michel Foucault left Marx's famous phrase that religion is the opium of masses and said instead, "Religion is the spirit of the spiritless world." He said that religion and Shia school of thought is capable of mobilizing masses from all walks of life and organizing them against the tyrannical ruling system. Imam Khomeini's revolution was so great and glorious that the French thinker and others like him were urged to write on its unique aspects, although they failed to fully understand the nature of the revolution and its peerless leader. Foucault wrote that the demonstrations in Iran had a sort of relation with congregational actions, religious rituals, and expression of public rights. He stressed that religion caused the Iranian nation to decide altogether to topple the tyrannical Shah and his corrupt government. The French writer believes that although there used to be a traditional form of Islam, this method of revolutionary Islam has given a new identity to the Iranian people and made them think of changing the entire life in every individual and social aspect. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. It's 44 years now since the Islamic Revolution ousted the brutal Western-backed Shah of Iran. But his son, Reza Pahlavi, still hankers after the pre-revolutionary era and is on a charm offensive to cultivate allies around the world. Only last month, he was grovelling to the Israeli regime and repeating highly offensive smears about the Islamic Republic's attitude towards Jews. But the Middle East's largest Jewish community outside the Zionist entity resides in the Islamic Republic, where they feel safe and respected. Pahlavi is also close to the United States, and Latifa Abachakra has this report about his recent visit to the Zionist entity and his efforts to curry favour with potential allies.
Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Western-backed brutal dictator, the Shah of Iran, visited occupied Palestine recently. Did he speak with the Palestinians, meet with the resistance, or visit Al-Aqsa? No, he did not even mention Palestine. Instead, in trying to present himself as the main figure opposing the Islamic Republic, he attempted to ingratiate himself with the Zionist entity. His visit was welcomed by the far-right Israeli government, which referred to him as the exiled crown prince of Iran. Pahlavi engaged in many activities with Zionist regime officials, including meeting Netanyahu, participating in a Holocaust Memorial Day event, and visiting and praying at the Western Wall. Amongst the most distasteful actions of Pahlavi and his wife Yasmin were visiting the racist settler family of Rabbi Leo D, after almost half of his family were eliminated in a resistance operation. D responded to the assassinations by saying, "Let the Israeli flag today send out a message to humanity, which is, we will never accept terror as legitimate." But of course, it's the flag of the so-called State of Israel that is the real symbol of terror. The British settler colonist revealed to Pahlavi that his family knew the family of the would-be dictator of Iran. Listen as he says he hopes that Pahlavi will be the king of Iran and that Pahlavi will welcome Dee to the palace in Tehran very soon.
I hope you'll be the king of Iran.
We hope to bring...
You can welcome me to the palace in Tehran.
Pahlavi's wife, Yasmin, also came under fire after she posted an image of a young female occupation forces member on her Instagram account with the Farsi equivalent of the hashtag Women, Life, Freedom. Of course, Pahlavi is a CIA asset. In the 1980s, legendary journalist Bob Woodward revealed that the Reagan administration authorized the CIA to support Pahlavi. His CIA funding reportedly ended after the Iran-Contra scandal, but it has resumed in recent years. Pahlavi is, though, only one of the many assets used by the US to attempt to subvert the Islamic Republic. In the emerging era of multipolarity, the Pahlavi Project needs all the allies it can get.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest expert today is Satara Siddiqui, who joined us earlier via Skype from Iran. Satara is a researcher and political analyst. She holds a PhD in American Studies, and she's the joint host of the Twice Told Tales podcast. The podcast was established to counter the profusion of misinformation and disinformation churned out by the West corporate media and political class. Welcome to the show. David, just remind us, will you, how Pahlavi's father actually came to power.
So the threat to Western interests was that the Mossadegh government wanted to nationalise the oil industry, which, of course, was the forerunner of BP.
Mossadegh back in the early 1950s.
In the 1950s. And so the MI6 wanted to perform a coup, but they couldn't get any support for quite a number of years, actually, from the CIA. Eventually, they persuaded the CIA to come in with them, and they launched a coup. And they got Mossadegh out, and they brought in the monarchy, the Shah, who then, of course, was so brutal that he was eventually overthrown in the Islamic Revolution in 1979. So there we are. That's the history of this, and that's what this guy wants to go back to. He refers to it as a constitutional monarchy, i.e. a Western-backed dictatorship. And that's, of course, the options that you have in Iran. You have either the Republic or you have a Western-backed dictatorship.
Well, I asked Satara how Pahlavi is viewed in Iran.
Remember very well, either because they experienced it firsthand or because they were told by their parents or read the history of the Pahlavi monarchy in Iran, that the monarchy of the Pahlavi was basically a puppet of the US, and the first Pahlavi was a puppet of the UK. And they remember how the SAVAK, the intelligence service of the Pahlavi, suppressed and tortured dissidents and imprisoned them. They remember how there was a huge rate of poverty, how there was a huge gap of income. They remember how the country was basically just obeying and bowing down to the U.S. policies. And they also remember, for example, that during the first Pahlavi, there was this attempt to forcefully remove women's hijab on the streets, and because the Pahlavi wanted to modernize Iran. And by modernizing Iran, it means only to just copy the dressing style of Europe.
David, I guess it's not surprising, is it, that the Zionist regime welcome Pahlavi to the place there? I mean, but, you know, in geopolitical terms, do you think it could damage them? And indeed, do you think it could even damage him, for that matter?
Well, I think we're moving into a period now where Israel is becoming even more unpopular than it has already been for many, many years. Even its closest supporters are raising questions about it, including in the US. The Pahlavi and the other oppositionists in Iran, they don't have any support really in Iran itself, and so that is the question: Will Pahlavi damage himself by associating himself with Zionists? Probably yes. And will the Zionists damage themselves by associating themselves with the opposition in Iran? Well, not so clearly, but of course they are geopolitically backing the opposition in Iran. They, of course, have direct involvement in terrorist attacks. They've killed nearly 10 nuclear scientists, murdered them in their cars, sometimes in Tehran. I've actually, when I was in Tehran just the other week, I saw the cars of I think 8 or 9 of the scientists who were assassinated by Mossad. So that's direct involvement. They're involved with the Kurds in Kurdistan, and they're involved in fostering terrorist attacks in Iran as well. So, of course, they have to support the opposition in Iran. But everybody knows, don't they, that the opposition that there is in Iran is sponsored by, yes, the Israelis, and also by the CIA.
Well, I also asked Sitara, I mean, what it actually says about the mindset of Pahlavi's wife, that she posted an image on social media of an occupation forces operative with the slogan, "Women, Life, Freedom."
Everyone in Iran, and obviously a lot of people outside Iran, even non-Iranians, found that very ironic, and they made comments on it. I also retweeted that and made comments because I found it very ludicrous that for the Pahlavi family, an IDF soldier could represent freedom for women, because we all know how the IDF has been oppressing Palestinians, both men and women and children, how the IDF has continues to kill and massacre Palestinians and to jail them and they have no mercy even to children. So it is ridiculous, but it is very much reflective of the Pahlavi mentality.
David, did you say a word or two, will you, about those British settlers who spoke to Pahlavi and said that their families knew each other? I mean, just say a bit about that.
It was quite an extraordinary moment.
Yes, it was.
I mean, this is a group of British settlers. The guy who's a rabbi, the father, used to be a rabbi in a synagogue in London, and he took the whole family out there into an illegal settlement, stolen Palestinian land, and then two of his daughters and his wife were eliminated by the resistance. And you see that little meeting that they have, and the videos are there on social media. And one of them says, "Well, actually, I think we know your relatives." And he says, "No, I don't think you do." And then they have this discussion where it becomes apparent that actually his relatives knew Pahlavi's relatives. And it really does illustrate the closeness of these kind of elites who are hostile to power coming from developing countries and challenging Western power. They're really very close to each other, such that their families even know each other. You know, who'd have thought that some kind of, if you like, random settler family in occupied Palestine would actually have potential family connections to the potential dictator of Iran?
Yes, absolutely. Curious state of affairs, I must say. But anyway, I also asked Sitara how she thinks the trip to occupied Palestine was received in Palestine and in Iran.
Well, I mean, the majority of the people here hates the Pahlavi family, and they have not forgotten the history of the oppression by this regime, the last dictator in Iran. But it received even more criticism because it happened at a time when inside the occupied territories, the Israeli regime was having problems with its own settlers. Like, the settlers were protesting inside the occupied lands against the Israeli regime. And it was at a time, or right after a time, when there were disputes and unrest inside the occupied territories and against the Israeli regime. So it was like double ironic. And even among Iranian expats that wants a change inside Iran, you could see that they were criticizing him because first he claimed that he represents the Iranian nation, but he does not. Nobody in Iran, not Iranians outside Iran, believe that Pahlavi represents them in any way. But it's also very ironic because he claimed that he's representing in Iran in meeting the Israeli regime officials. And he also forgot that the same Netanyahu that he's praising had previously in a statement in his account of the Bible story was humiliating Iranians and was accusing Iranians of being hostile to the Jewish people, which is not true. I come from a city where we have active synagogues, we have active churches, and obviously active mosques, because it's like the city of Isfahan is known to be the home to Armenian Christians and Iranian Jewish people, and Jewish people have representatives in the Iranian parliament.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, as we've got another report now about Pahlavi's frantic efforts to drum up support.
The temporary Zionist entity appears more and more doomed with each passing week. It is hard to tell which is the more desperate: the pretender to the non-existent throne of Iran, or the faltering occupation of Palestine. Pahlavi is desperate to strut the world stage, pressing his claim to the throne, and to try and gain support anywhere he can, even from the irreducibly racist settler colony. At the same time, his CIA sponsors try and present a broad opposition movement to the Islamic Republic of Iran. On January the 1st, they published a coordinated message on social media. Reza Pahlavi was joined by CIA stooge Mashi Alinejad and several others, including grassroots activists and president and spokesman of the Association of Victims' Families of Flight PS752, Hamid Eshmaelian. They met collectively in late March in Toronto, but since then their collective has appeared to be shaky, with at least one member leaving. It seems Pahlavi didn't tell the rest of his comrades that he was planning to collude with the temporary Zionist entity. After Palestine, Pahlavi then jetted off to Italy to be greeted with praise by far-right monarchist supporters as he lobbied the far-right Italian government to further punish the people of Iran via sanctions. Meanwhile, in the temporary Zionist entity, hitherto allies seem to be moving away at an alarming speed. The Chinese brokered deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the restoration of diplomatic relations with Syria and Iran by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, the talks between Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey, the possible end of the war in Yemen, even the US is cautious of its traditional ally, are all bad news for the Zionist entity. Pahlavi and the Zionist entity envisage the end of the Islamic Republic, which they hasten to bring about. But the reality is that the Republic is on the multipolar side of history, and the collapse of the unipolar US power will only mean that the liberation of Palestine is hastened from the river to the sea.
Well, I asked Sitara how she thinks the emerging multipolarity is influencing how the world sees Iran and Palestine.
That's true. I think with the attempts to de-dollarize transactions across the world, with attempts to shift from relying on US from being more self-reliant and being for more cooperative with China and Russia as the other superpowers. We are seeing more examples of how nations can now be brave enough, I would say, to stand to the U.S. Bullying policies and to figure out a way that works better for their own nation and for the people of the world. This also includes more pressure on the Israeli regime, because as more people and as more nations want their governments, want their states to stand against the U.S., they also want more gestures of rejecting the Israeli apartheid regime and the occupation in Palestine.
David, we just heard in the package there that the CIA's attempt to cobble together a broad opposition movement to the Islamic Republic is faltering. I mean, would you say that Palestine was influential in the fracturing of that coalition?
It would seem so. I mean, it seems that him neglecting to tell his erstwhile colleagues that he was going to Palestine has caused the fracturing to happen, because, of course, to associate for people in Iran, like the guy from the campaign for the people who were shot down in that Ukrainian aircraft, I mean, that's kind of a red line issue. And that you know, so that actually aligning with the Zionist entity is difficult for those in the Iranian opposition, because they're so widely hated in Iran. But let me just say about this Ukrainian airline, I mean, it's a really interesting case. This is people might not remember, it's a Ukrainian passenger airline which was shot down accidentally by the IRGC. Now, this guy is campaigning for the people who were killed in Iran and outside Iran. But, of course, what's just happened in Iran is that the people who were responsible, the military people who were responsible, have just been found guilty in court and sentenced to prison sentences. And it's an extraordinary contrast with countries like the UK or the US, where people who are in power, the police or the military, rarely, if ever, go to jail. And that's a really real contrast. It shows the difference in Iranian politics and the way in which Palestine might, therefore, have a key role in fracturing a coalition like this, much to the disappointment of the CIA.
Not only do they not go to jail, but people that expose abuses, war crimes,
themselves,
I'm thinking Julian Assange, for example, ends up in prison as a political prisoner being tortured, actually in solitary confinement in Belmarsh while waiting extradition to the US. Well, anyway, I asked Satara for her thoughts on the divisions amongst this purported unified coalition being presented by the CIA.
Well, these people and these so-called opposition figures had a lot of disagreements from the beginning. And those of us inside Iran who could see through the propaganda could see the fall and the collapse of this so-called coalition coming very soon. They all agreed that they didn't want the Islamic Republic, but what they did not agree on was what to replace the Islamic Republic with and how to fight in their imagination, the Islamic Republic. They also were so detached from the realities on the ground in Iran that they thought they are reflecting the will, power of or what the Iranians actually want, which was not true. I mean, Iranians inside Iran, they, like any other nation, like any other democratic nation, they might have disagreements and dissatisfactions with parts of the functions of the government, and they know how to voice that. They know how to pursue changes. And we have been doing that through our parliament and different government bodies and electing different people into power. But these people just wanted to pursue their own agenda.
David, just remind us, will you, about Masih Ahmadinejad and her involvement in directing protests in Iran.
Well, she was one of the leaders of the Women Life Freedom protests. She lives in New York,
yes.
But she was one of the leaders from there. And, of course, her day job is as a paid propagandist by the American government. She works for Voice of America, has received from the American government almost $500,000 in the last eight or nine years for her work effectively lying about Iran. Mm. And here she is in this coalition as a potential leader of a new government in Iran. When, you know, everybody knows that this is simply a CIA operative working on behalf of the US government and its interests, and not someone who has any role in thinking about the interests of the people of Iran. And she was one of the ones who tried to pretend that this was all about the hijab and women's rights. But of course, mm-hmm. her real demands are increased sanctions, which will only help, harm the people mm-hmm. of Iran, as opposed to improving women's rights. Mm-hmm. So that, this is an indication, really, of the level of the people who are involved in the opposition.
Mm. Oh, you say everybody knows, but of course some people are indeed duped, aren't they, by the propaganda and think this woman is some sort of heroine. I mean, you know, we see this on social media, don't we?
It's example. Extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it's the weaponization of feminism by US imperial power. I mean, you know, we ought to be able to understand that now. It's like, yes. As people say, you ought to be able to walk and chew gum. Yeah, I mean,
no, indeed.
You know, feminism and women's rights are not the same as US imperial power.
No, absolutely. And this is coming to light more and more, and hopefully people are kind of waking up. But I think people are indeed more and more waking up. Well, anyway, I asked Sitara if she thinks the issue of Palestine is likely to win Pahlavi any friends in the Iranian opposition or elsewhere.
I think so. As I said, he is so detached from the realities on the ground. He hasn't been inside Iran. He has not been working. I mean, he's been sitting there and receiving money from the U.S. government, probably from Iran's and Iranians' frozen assets. He doesn't make any attempt to understand what the Iranians inside Iran actually want. So I would say, yes, I think this came from a very wishful thinking, from a very, it was coming from a very big lack of understanding of what the Iranians actually want. But if he actually even looked back at the history of Iranian support for Palestine, for the Palestinian cause, even during his father's ruling over Iran, he would understand how the Iranian nation has always been supportive of Palestine.
Well, finally, David, I mean, the abundant signs of emerging multipolarity are all around us, aren't they? I mean, does that influence, do you think, how we should interpret Pahlavi's visit?
I think it does. I think that if this had happened 3 months ago or 4 months ago, before multipolarity really gathered pace with the brokering by the Chinese of the Saudi-Iran deal, then we would see it differently. But because we've now seen all of this, and the most recent, of course, is the Saudis cozying up to Hezbollah, which is a truly, truly extraordinary thing. Who would have thought, absolutely, even a month ago, that would be on the cards?
Indeed.
And these things are coming thick and fast. And so the changes are all really quite self-evident in a way, but it's not clear how those changes will have an impact. We do know in relation to the Zionist entity, for example, as we've shown in this programme just the other week, that the US is becoming increasingly skeptical of the Zionist entity, and have the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, the CIA sidekick, has been funding some of the demonstrations inside Israel, which is extraordinary. Mm. So the way in which Pahlavi and the Zionists are putting themselves on the wrong side of multipolarity is an indication, really, of their weakness, because as the power leaches away from the US, they won't have the big bad boy in the corner to be their friend anymore.
Indeed. Well, we're certainly living in interesting times, aren't we? I'm afraid that's it for today's show. I want to thank our guests, Sitara Siddiqui, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
WHO's Director General has recently said the COVID-19 pandemic has been on a downward trend, but the risk of new variants remain. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the World Health Organization, WHO, announced recently that COVID-19 is no longer a public health emergency of international concern, or PHEIC. WHO's Director General Tedros Adhanom made the decision following a recommendation by the organization's COVID-19 Emergency Committee. During a meeting, the committee highlighted the decreasing trend in deaths and hospitalizations and the high levels of population immunity against SARS-CoV-2 as reasons for ending the PHEIC. During a press conference the following day, Tedros emphasized that COVID-19 remains a global health threat and said that the new status doesn't mean that countries should let down their guard. It's time for countries to transition from emergency mode to managing COVID-19 alongside other infectious diseases, he said. The announcement didn't come as a surprise. After the emergency committee's last meeting in late January, Tedros acknowledged that the pandemic was probably at a transition point. This is not a snap decision. It is a decision that has been considered carefully for some time, planned for, and made on the basis of a careful analysis of the data, he said during the press conference. A PHEIC, defined by the WHO as an extraordinary event that constitutes a public health risk to other countries through the international spread of disease, is the highest level of international public health alarm. The COVID-19 PHEIC was declared on January 30, 2020. In practice, this decision compelled countries to start reporting cases to the WHO to create worldwide surveillance. Importantly, it's signaling to all countries